Welcome to the Great Detectives of Old Time Radio from Boise, Idaho. This is your host, Adam Graham. If you have a comment, email it to me. Box 13 at greatdetectives.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Detectives and become one of our friends on Facebook, facebook.com/radiodetectives. Well, I do want to let you know before we get started that you can help support the show as you make your summer vacation plans. Just go to JohnnyDollarAir.com when making your plans. JohnnyDollarAir.com is a Priceline affiliate, so you have the option to choose from great everyday deals on airline, travel, hotels, and rental car, or to name your own price. And if you book your travel off of JohnnyDollarAir.com, part of your purchase goes to support the show. So it's a great way to save money and help support the Great Detectives of Old Time Radio. So just remember, go to JohnnyDollarAir.com and check that first when making travel plans. All right. Well, now we're going to begin a new series, the Carter Brown Mysteries. Carter Brown Mysteries were based on the books by the novelist Alan Jeffrey Yates, who, when writing mysteries, went by the name Carter Brown. He wrote under some other names, Todd Conway when he wrote westerns, Caroline Farr when writing romance, and Paul Valdez. But Carter Brown Mysteries, some of the most prolifically written, and this Australian series from the late 50s actually serialized Carter Brown stories in a series of 15-minute episodes. Plus, with each serial featuring a different detective, this will work well because there are some Fridays where we're not going to have four straight weeks in a row because of missing episodes or some quirk in the Johnny Dollar serial that we're playing that week. So each serial can be listened to as a detective in and of itself. Series started airing in 1958, and we've got the first series. So we're going to present for you tonight Call for Calmness, Part 1, and then when we return, be ready to find out the end of the Molly Kay matter.
Carter Brown Mysteries. Adventures in excitement and suspense, based on the best-selling novels by the slick storytelling sensation, Carter Brown. We take pride in bringing you the first of a new series, the program drawn from the celebrated books by Carter Brown, which have sold more than 10 million copies and continue to sell at the rate of over a million copies a year. Each week you'll hear a complete story dramatized in the smooth modern style which has been responsible for Carter Brown's enormous popularity both in Australia and abroad. And here to introduce the Carter Brown Mystery Theater is Carter Brown himself.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? I'm very pleased indeed, and I must admit flattered too, to have been asked to present my stories to you.
Mr. Brown, I know you've led a pretty adventurous life yourself. You've traveled around the world as a salesman, publicity writer, film technician, and now, finally, as a best-selling author. And quite a number of people seem to think that the heroes in your stories are really yourself. Now, is that true?
No, it's not. And if I sound very definite about that, it's because my wife's listening to me, and I don't think she'd like the idea of my running into so many gorgeous blondes, brunettes, and redheads as the gentlemen in my books do.
No, nor, I suppose, into as much trouble as they do.
No, I don't think she'd like that either, I hope.
Yes, your heroes certainly do wind up in strife, don't they? Like Johnny Lane, for instance. Johnny's a newspaper columnist, and they've got a premium on problems. Not that they all run into the same kind of bother as Johnny. They wouldn't want to. Well, he's a cocky character with an eye for a beautiful babe and printer's ink instead of blood. But suppose you find out for yourselves. Here's Johnny Lane to tell the story which we've titled Call for a Columnist.
I was feeling pretty pleased with myself and hence with the world. I had the best table in Jules' night spot, courtesy of Monsieur Jules himself, and on the table was my favorite drink and my favorite reading matter, a copy of the News, open at the best part of the paper, my own column, Dynamite with Johnny Lane, syndicated in 68 newspapers throughout the United States with an estimated 4 million readers. Yes, as far as I was concerned, life was a great big rosy bubble with Johnny Lane riding on top of it. Then the bubble burst.
Excuse me, Monsieur Lane.
Yes, Jules, my friend, what is it?
There are two gentlemen to see you, monsieur, in my private office.
Jules, I never see anyone in your private office, you know that. Well,
these gentlemen are from the police.
Oh, well, that makes a difference.
Monsieur Lane, I would not like any trouble.
Don't worry, I'll handle them. You stick with your customers.
Thank you, monsieur.
Well, well. I feel honored, gentlemen. Chief of Police O'Byrne and Captain Stanger in person. And together. Whose piggy bank has been robbed?
Cut the clowning, Lane. This is serious.
Oh, you intrigue me, Captain. Tell me more.
We wanted to talk about your column, Johnny.
A subject I am always happy to discuss, Chief.
It's about the item concerning Albert Ferraro. I've got a copy here.
Uh-huh.
You said, mobster happy Albert Ferraro won't get around much anymore. Not since he had unexpected visitors at 2 a.m. this morning. Rumor had it that Albert was going to sing to Senator Rowland's committee investigating vice and allied rackets in our fair city. This morbid columnist is betting that Albert sang his swan song in the small hours to an unsympathetic audience, with a hay and a hoe and no flowers by request. Who is the Mr. Big who's worried by Senator Rowland's questions? Keep reading this column, folks, and I'll let you know just as soon as I find out.
Not bad, Chief. You really haven't got the style for it. Or the voice.
This paper was out on the streets at 3 a.m., just 1 hour after Ferraro had his unexpected visitors. It takes more than an hour to print your paper, Johnny. And that means you put that item in before it happened.
Just a hunch, Chief. If I'd been proved wrong, I'd have had to wriggle out of it in tomorrow's column.
But you haven't been proved wrong, Johnny.
As soon as we read your item, we called on Albert. Guess what? He was at home, with a nylon stocking wound round his throat. Tight.
Well, that's what you get for sticking your neck out.
Maybe you should see things the way we do, Johnny. We have to take Senator Rowland's investigation seriously. The more he uncovers on the vice activities in this city, the worse it looks for the police. Sure, we bust up a lot of small stuff, but the big stuff still goes on and we can't get a lead. So, when we read our paper, we find that the one lead which might really have opened things up for us was never given to us. Until it was too late.
Oh, come, gentlemen, let's be fair. You get the same opportunities as I have for getting information. Better. If I happen to have outsmarted you on this one, it's no use feeling sore about it, is it? You just have to do better next time.
Chief, let me bust him on the jaw, just once.
It wouldn't look good to his 4 million readers. Johnny, all I want to know is where you got your information from.
Sorry, Chief, that's confidential. Now look, I've got more than 100 people in this city who hand me information. Two things that are always sure of. Their money and my discretion. What happens if I tell you where the whisper about Albert came from? Word goes around and Lane can't be trusted. My column gets shot to heck.
Okay, Johnny. I guess we'll just have to plug on with our own plotting methods. I see you're going to let us know pretty soon who the Mr. Big is. We'll be really interested in that. You got any life insurance, Johnny?
Life insurance? What?
I was just hoping you got plenty, because I don't think you'll find anybody willing to give you more. You're a bad risk now.
I'm afraid I don't quite follow.
If we're interested in your story about Ferraro, how much more interested do you think Mr. Big is going to be? And when he gets around to asking you about it, I don't think he'll take that confidential routine as an answer. Let's go, Captain. So long, Johnny. Or should it be
Goodbye.
I'm not a nervous character, but as O'Byrne and Stanger walked out, I suddenly found myself dabbing my forehead with a handkerchief. There ought to be a law against policemen going around frightening people. Well, I decided I could use a drink back at my table. Didn't waste time apologizing to the people I knocked over to get there.
Monsieur Lane, everything was all right?
Yeah, sure, Jules. Don't give it another thought.
Oh, I am grateful. Monsieur Lane, there is someone who would like to say hello to you.
I never say hello to anyone. That's one of my principles.
Hello, Mr. Lane.
I turned to look at her, a startlingly beautiful face framed by close-cropped black hair and a set of curves that had sent a racing car driver dizzy. My principal shot through the ceiling. Well, hello.
This is the feminine half of the new act I am presenting. The Adagio dancers, Simon and Simone. You saw them last night, Mr. Lane.
Oh, yeah.
Did you like it, Mr. Lane?
You bet. Especially the end of it, where he throws you across the floor and you spin out of sight on your, where you spin out of sight.
Effective, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a good way to test the floor for splinters. Will you join me?
I'd love to.
You will excuse me, aren't you?
I hope your husband isn't going to take exception to you having a drink with me.
My husband? Oh, Simon, he is not my husband.
Oh, that makes it worse.
He is just my partner.
That makes it better.
I want to say how much I admire you, Mr. Lane, for what you're doing now.
You mean holding your hand?
Of course not. I mean, in exposing the criminal elements in the town, helping Senator Roder.
Oh, that's nothing. I'll pour you a drink.
I think you are a very brave man. I imagine you carry your life in your hands this very minute.
Well, what makes you say that?
It's obvious. I'm sure that most of the underworld must get mad at the mere mention of your name. Their only logical solution to stop you printing these revelations is to remove you, isn't it?
No!
I can't see any other alternative.
Well, I guess you can't.
Still, you must know all this, Johnny. I shouldn't be worrying you with it. But I just wanted you to know how much I admire your courage in doing it. Oh, I'll have to go. We're on in 15 minutes. Maybe we could continue this conversation after my act is over.
I've got to get home and get out my column. Can I take a rain check for some other night?
Any night, Johnny. Say, tomorrow?
My customary cab was waiting outside the night spot. Part of the service for a celebrity. I got in, gave the driver the address, my penthouse. We made about two blocks when I noticed he was studying my face in the rear vision mirror. What's the matter, driver? Have I got smallpox?
You're Johnny Lane, aren't you? Newspaper guy.
Yeah, that's right. Want my autograph?
No, I never get past the funnies. But my wife reads your column.
Oh, she like it?
Well, I don't know whether she likes it. She don't ever say, but remember they published your photo a couple of months ago?
Oh, I believe they did. I asked them not to, but they told me they were sick and tired of the letters demanding to know was I as handsome as they imagined me to be.
Yeah, well, the old lady sees it, and she don't believe it.
It happened to be a good likeness, that's all.
That's what I'm going to tell her when I get home. She said she didn't believe any guy could look as dumb as that. Here we are.
How much do I owe you?
I got 98 cents on the clock, Mr. Lane.
Here's a dollar. You can keep the change.
Hey, what do I do with the 2 cents?
Endow an orphanage. I rode the elevator to the top floor and reached my keys as I moved down the passageway to the penthouse door. I could hear the phone ringing inside, and I opened the door in a hurry. Hello?
Is that Johnny Lane?
None other. Who's that?
I'm so glad you published that item I gave you about Albert.
Yeah, well, it's got me into a lot of trouble with the police. They want to know how I knew what was going to happen before it happened.
Did you tell them?
Well, how could I? I don't know myself. All I know is you keep calling me up. You won't tell me who you are. All you do is give me tips for the column.
Think how it impresses your 4 million readers.
I have no ambition to spend a few years behind bars for the sake of impressing my readers.
Don't kid me, Johnny Lane. You'd dive off the Statue of Liberty into the Hudson wearing a bikini if you thought it'd get you another 10,000 circulation.
I'll let that pass.
I've got another news item for you if you're interested.
I'm interested.
There's a honky-tonk down on Sloane Street called the Blue Diamond, run by Lou Prigger. If the good Senator Rowland would like to know, that's the distribution center for goofballs. So long, Johnny.
Hey, wait a minute. It's time you tell me who you are. How can I tell the police my information comes from an anonymous phone call? They just as soon believe people go to see Marilyn Monroe because they like to hear her sing. What the... Hey, hang on to yourself, kid. It's under the door. Okay, I'm counting.
Just move back quietly, Mr. Lane, and we'll close the door.
Hey, that's a gun!
Your eyesight's 20/20, Mr. Lane. So get inside where we'll be nice and private.
Welcome back. It's worth noting here that, while a lot of these, and I think most of these Carter Brown mystery radio programs we have out there are set in the United States, Carter Brown actually wrote about the United States and used it as a setting long before he ever came to visit the country. It was very popular with Australians at the time to have stories set in the U.S., the accents and stuff, given that the actors are actually Australian, I think they do a better job. In some ways, better than some of the BBC stuff I've seen from television in the 1970s and 80s. So, pretty solid performance by the players here. Now we turn to part five of the Molly Kay Matter.
From Hollywood, it's time now for Bob Bailey as...
Johnny Dollar.
Johnny, I've got it for you.
Liu Tang. Good. What did you find out?
That prices on the Tokyo grain market did break suddenly about 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks? Uh-huh.
Reason, oversupply. The price has been holding since at about 60% of the peak.
A 40% drop, big enough to cause the damage.
What damage?
The sinking of the Molly Kay. A double cross, a frame-up, murder. It's as clear as crystal, Lou.
Come see me later tonight. Tell me all about it.
All right.
Or at any rate, come on, tell me about something.
About a certain night in Paris, maybe?
I think I'd like that very much, Johnny.
Wait for me, Lou. I'll be there later. You can count on it.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. From Special Investigator Johnny Dollar, location San Francisco, to the Home Office Marine and Maritime Casualty Limited, Hartford, Connecticut. Assignment, the Molly Kay Matter. Expense account, final page. Item 9, 770, long-distance calls to Hartford and New York. I was pretty sure before I called, but I had to check on it. It checked. Item 10, 80 cents, taxi from my hotel to the waterfront office of Inspector Dan McKay, Harbor Police.
It's a funny deal, Johnny. I can't figure. Captain Brawley is clammed up tight. Won't answer any more questions. Doesn't want a lawyer. Won't even talk. It's a funny deal.
Not when you consider the fact that he's innocent.
What? What you said...
I know, I argued the opposite. I was wrong, Dan.
What is it, Johnny? Just plain stubbornness?
No, but that's what it is with Captain Brawley. Maybe that's the tip-off, his stubborn bullheadedness. The human elements you mentioned.
How you figuring it?
If Brawley were in a money jam, he'd never scheme and connive at planning a thing like that of sinking his own ship. He's too stubborn. And besides, he wasn't in a jam, I'm sure of it.
Well, now, wait a minute. He had a $100,000 mortgage to meet.
I finagled some information out of the bank. The Brawley Shipping Company has a free balance of nearly $150,000 in cash assets.
Yeah, but look here, Johnny.
Now, you look. I started out with a motive, and I built a pretty strong case on it. Even you agreed. Everything pointed toward Captain Brawley. Sure, because somebody was helping things point toward him.
What do you mean?
It wasn't just the ship itself that was insured.
I'm still lost, Johnny. Keep talking.
All right, look. That cargo of grain was also insured by the owner with another company, not mine, and for top market value, full price.
Yeah, well, keep talking.
All right. The Tokyo grain market broke just 4 days before the Molly Kay was due to sail the first time. The shipper stood to lose nearly half his investment if the grain reached Yokohama at that time. Well, it didn't reach there. It's lying out there on the bottom of the Pacific. Net result, instead of taking a loss because of price, the shipper gets full price from the insurance company. It adds up, Dan.
Yeah, it sure does. The shipper.
I think Captain Brawley suspected him, too. That's what kept the old captain on the prod. His ship gone, under suspicion for the sinking, yet not wanting to hurt his daughter. He was caught right in the middle. But keep on holding him to make it look like we still think he's the guilty party.
Well, it's that girl of his I feel sorry for, Ellen. She's the one caught in the middle.
Yeah, I know. And it's going to be rough on her when she finds out. Engaged to a killer who's been using her to smash her own father. Great setup.
Yeah. Well, I'll get a bulletin out. We'll pick up this Dean Sutton and bring him in. Yeah, but you know something? It'll be awful hard to pin it on him. Need evidence, something definite.
Look, why don't you let me have a go at him first?
Oh, it's out of the question, Johnny. Of course, if you should happen to find him before we do, well...
Yeah, I might just do that, Dan. In fact, I've kind of got a hunch I will. It was a hunch, but it might be a good one. I left Dan's office and walked east along the waterfront, following the long curve of the Embarcadero with its miles of docks and wharves. The night had settled down over the bay and the city, and with it a dark, damp blanket of fog, even heavier than the night before. And because of that and other reasons, I felt cold and lonesome and alone. I turned off the Embarcadero and walked out Pier 29. I was about 30 yards from the Brawley warehouse when I was suddenly brought up short. On the water below me, tied to a wharf piling, was a light cabin cruiser rocking gently with the swell. It had no business being there. Pier 29 was a commercial berth. My hunch was right. I moved quietly to the edge of the wharf and stood watching the little cruiser for several minutes. There was no sign of life, no sound. Finally, I climbed over the dock rail, down the wharf ladder, and stepped onto the deck. Still no sound, no movement. I moved over to the companionway door leading down below decks and reached out my hand for the latch. Then I stopped short, caught suddenly by a sharp feeling of danger. It wasn't a sense of being watched. It was deeper, more subtle, more vague. I tried to shake it off, reach again for the latch. Then the boat shifted slightly and the dim glow from the wharf light overhead moved across the hatchway door. Inches in front of my face, I saw the glint of bare copper wires, all set to make contact if the door was open. One more move and I'd have been blown sky high. That boat was booby-trapped. There was a light burning in the office of the Brawley Shipping Company. I knocked on the door, drew my gun, then I stepped back and waited. I leveled the gun on the door.
Johnny!
Are you alone, Ellen?
Yes, of course.
Well, come on, let's get inside.
What is it, Johnny?
Have you seen Dean Sutton tonight?
I tried to find him, but I couldn't. My father's been arrested, charged with murder.
Yeah, I know, honey.
I came here to go over the company records to see if I could find something that might help him, anything.
Ellen, I...
Johnny, look. Look at this mess. Somebody's been here. Files dumped in the middle of the floor, papers all over the place.
Yeah, looks like they're planning to start a bonfire. Say, tell me something, Ellen. Does Dean Sutton own a boat?
Yes. Light cabin cruiser named the Piper. Why?
It's tied up at the wharf. He's around here somewhere.
Well, what of it? What do you mean?
Your father didn't sink the Molly Kay. Dean Sutton did it.
He wasn't even on board.
He didn't have to be. He hired an explosive expert named Benny Wong to do the job. He got your father to take Benny on as steward.
That's the man they're accusing father of murdering.
Dean is the one who did it, using your father's gun.
But why?
To collect the insurance on that cargo of grain. Oh, look, I know it's a rough deal, honey, and I know how you feel. But I guess your best bet is to chalk it up to experience. At least your father's in the clear now.
I think I sensed it, Johnny. That something was wrong with Dean. Badly wrong. I guess that's why I felt like turning to you instead of him. Why I still feel that way. I think I'm going to cry.
Then cry. Cry it out and get it over with.
Come here, Ellen. I held her close and tried to comfort her. She pressed her face against my chest and whimpered like a hurt kid. I kept stroking her hair, breathing in the scent of her perfume. Perfume. The same perfume that had hung in the air of the room where Benny Wong was killed. The pieces shifted, fell into place again. The puzzle was finally solved, but too late. Because I could feel the muzzle of the gun she was pressing against my side.
Easy now, Johnny. Turn around slow and get your hands up. That's the idea. Now stay that way. I'm a dead shot, Johnny. If you doubt it, ask Benny Wong.
Right under my nose. Right from the start. How wrong can a guy be?
As wrong as you were, Johnny.
It had to be you. There was no chance for Dean to steal your father's gun and then return it. Not unless you were in on it with him.
It was my idea. Dean's too weak to plan a thing like that. He has to be propped up and pushed.
And you're just the girl to do it.
You ought to know.
Yeah, I do now.
It's too bad. I like the way you kiss. Any chance of working something out, Johnny? Or are you too honest?
So that's it. The next step is to get rid of Dean. And you've already got the trap set.
Not yet. But I'll think of something. I'm clever, Johnny. Don't you think so?
I heard footsteps coming along the wharf. Dean Sutton. I had only seconds to think of something, so I took a chance, edged back against the wall, inched over closer to the door.
That's far enough. Don't push your luck. There's Dean coming now. He went after some gasoline. We're going to build a nice warm fire, and you're going to have a ringside seat. Come on in, Dean. We've got a visitor.
Dollar, what do you know? So you walked right into it. Just like a gun.
Chance paid off. He walked between us, blocked Ellen's line of fire, and I jumped him. I grabbed him around the neck, held him as a shield, dragged him back out through the door, out to the wharf.
Dean! Break loose! Let me get a shot at him!
I was trying to get clear of the light before Ellen could blast me with that gun, and I made it. But Dean broke loose, came at me swinging. He slipped and staggered up against the dock rail. The railing broke, split in two, and we went over the side. We struggled back up to the surface. Dean's hands were clenched on my throat, and I couldn't break his grip. Ellen started firing from the wharf above us, not knowing who she'd hit and not caring. I took a deep breath and dragged Dean under the surface. But his hands were still on my throat, and I couldn't break loose. My lungs were bursting. My strength was going fast. I brought up my knee. He fell away from me. I was free. Free to fight my way back up to the surface. I swam around in circles, getting my breath, watching for Dean, but he didn't come up. He didn't come up for 2 days. When I climbed up the ladder onto the wharf, Ellen was nowhere in sight. I heard somebody running toward me, saw the flashing red light back at the land end of the pier, and I knew why she'd left. Dan McKay and his boys.
Johnny! Johnny!
Hey, over here, Dan.
Are you all right, Johnny?
Yeah, I'm all right. Do you see Ellen Brawley?
Well, some girl ran up the wharf there, tore that cruiser.
That boat's got a booby trap on it. Come on, Dan.
All right. What's she doing here?
She was in on it, too. Dean's in the water, drowned, I guess.
Look, there she is, climbing down off the wharf.
Ellen, stop.
She's on the cruiser.
No.
Ellen!
She's gonna try... Look out!
Get down! Flat on your face. If she opens that hatch...
Blown to bits.
Booby trap. They had it rigged for me, and she... No. She didn't know about it. That wasn't meant for me. They were both pulling a double cross. Dean set that trap for her. End of expense account, except hotel and plane fare back home. Total $547.60. Well, it looks like the company pays off on this one, Dave. The ship owner was innocent. But you'll make it back. I really feel sorry for Captain Brawley. He commanded his own quarterdeck for 25 years. Strong and proud and unafraid. He had a wife once named Molly Kay and a ship named Molly Kay. And he had a daughter, too. And now the sea has taken all of them away from him and left him cast up on the beach, a broken old man. Bitter, beaten, alone. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Now, here's our star, Bob Bailey, to tell you about next week's story.
Thanks. Next week, the case of a man who didn't exist, except for one thing. He suddenly showed up. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by Les Crutchfield, the entire production is under the direction of Jack Johnstone. Heard in this week's cast were Virginia Gregg, Peter Leeds, Barney Phillips, Victor Perrin, James McCallion, and Hi Averback. Be sure to join us on Monday night, same time and station, for another exciting story of Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
Welcome back. Well, it's worth noting because listeners are going to figure it out anyway. I'll get some emails on it if I don't mention it. So I'll go ahead and mention it. This particular episode of Johnny Dollar represents a very rare writing fail on behalf of the writers. The key point here is at the end of part four, Johnny discovers the daughter's perfume at the scene of the crime. And in this one, despite that, he's just as clueless and innocent as a lamb about her possible guilt and complicity in the matter. And I can't help but think that that sort of slip may have been a result of the requirements and the expectations of getting out these five-part Johnny Dollar stories. The way it sounds to me, it sounds like the writer intended for this to come out, you know, as he was holding her in this episode, but that somehow or another, it may have been, you know, we want to have a cliffhanger, something that'll have the audience ready to listen. So it looks like the author, you know, went in and he wrote the cliffhanger into part four and then forgot, that it was a big reveal in part five. So a rare lapse here on Johnny Dollar. A couple of names in the credits worth noting. Barney Phillips, really solid as Captain Brawley. And Virginia Gregg. You know, I wish we had more detailed cast credits for these. I wouldn't be surprised if she played the one-time girlfriend of Johnny and the daughter of the captain. I think she could have pulled both of them off. And she has done multiples. There are a few surviving scripts that show Virginia Gregg's versatility. All right. Well, now we turn to listener comments and feedback, and we have an iTunes review from the Bird Lady. I just started listening to this podcast after listening to all the Dragnet ones for the second time. The first time, the commentary is interesting. After that, I can recite the words myself. That being said, the sound quality is good, and I really enjoy the variety and quality of the podcast. I'll probably start on Dragnet again. I'm hooked and listen to it every day. Well, thanks so much for listening. Well, that will do it for today. Join us back here on Monday for our next episode of Johnny Dollar. Next week, we'll also, on Friday, we'll bring you part two of Call for a Columnist. And join us tomorrow for the lineup. In the meanwhile, send your comments to Box 13 at GreatDetectives.net. Follow us on Twitter, Radio Detectives, and become one of our friends on Facebook, Facebook.com/Radio Detectives. From Boise, Idaho, though, this is your host, Adam Graham, signing off.